Hey everyone, it's Carter. Welcome to this episode of Making It Up, the show where I talk to writers of all shapes and sizes and backgrounds and talent level and bestsellerdom status level and interests and hobbies and whatever, just writers. And we just kind of shoot the shit for a while. And I kind of explore into their brains the best I can. And at the end, we make up a story together. So today, I had the honor and privilege of talking to Maureen Johnson, who has a hell of a bio. Maureen Johnson is the number one New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of several YA novels, including 13 Little Blue Envelopes, Sweet Scarlet, The Name of the Star, and Truly Devious. She's also done collaborative works such as Let It Snow with John Green and Lauren Miracle, which is now a Netflix show, which is super cool, and several works in the Shadowhunter universe with Cassandra Clare. So she's a big deal, and she's very cool, and she's hysterical. You should go to her website, MaureenJohnsonBooks.com, because it's really funny. But we talked about all sorts of cool things, and her new book, her latest book, The Box in the Woods, is out now. And she's a hell of a mystery writer with a fantastic imagination. And I had a blast talking to her. And at the end, we actually didn't quite make up a story together. We did a kind of a different thing. So you'll hear about that when you get to the end of the show. So here it is. Enjoy my conversation with Maureen Johnson. I wanted to ask you a little bit about just, you know, what I tend to do is look more into people's past and kind of why they do what they do. And I'm always curious. I've had a lot of people on about, you know, where kind of that nugget of creativity came from, kind of what your family life was like. Did you come from a creative family?
No.
Not at all?
No. I mean... certainly not in their jobs. My mother's a nurse.
Okay.
My father worked as an engineer. They're very kind of straight down the line people. So yeah, there was no one in my family that nobody did anything. Like everyone else kind of worked in a sheet metal factory or worked in a lampshade factory. Or like, you know, there was nobody that was... There were no artists in the family, for sure.
Yeah. Huh. That's interesting. And siblings?
I don't have any.
Okay. Okay. And so you're growing up in Philly, in a ostensibly uncreative family.
Yeah. I mean, my mother did a lot of crafts, and I think she made a lot more stuff than she gave herself credit for, but she is also just very straight-laced. Like,
yeah.
Like if she did a craft, it looked exactly like the thing. Like if she didn't, she took an oil painting class, but the duck looked like a duck, you know, but she,
there were no coloring outside the lines.
Oh no.
that was verboten.
No, nobody minded that I was like that, but yeah. it wasn't a thing.
So what were you like as an only child growing up? Were you, I mean, the people I've talked to who have been only child, there's a lot of only children have been, you know, oh, I was in the library all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of a thing. Were you similar to that?
Yeah, I was a big reader. There was just a lot. I was not an outdoor child. I was very put out by having to go outside.
Were you guys in the city in Philly?
No, in the suburbs.
Okay. Okay. But you just, yeah, the sunshine and fresh cut lawns didn't appeal to you.
I love a fresh cut lawn. Like I love kind of sitting outside and reading, but yeah. I wasn't one of those people that's like sports.
Yeah. Yeah.
Certainly. I was like, why would we do this to ourselves when we could be sitting and reading? Or, you know, I was definitely that person.
Yeah. What kind of stuff do you remember what you were gravitating towards in terms of what you were reading when you were young?
A lot of mysteries. Every single mystery I could possibly get my hands on. A surprising amount of funny political essay writing for an 8 year old. Like, I was like, what 8 year old doesn't love to read Art Buchwald?
Right. Oh, you really develop a good vocabulary by reading enough George Will, too.
Oh, yeah. Like, who doesn't? Who doesn't love that as a child?
So what the hell was that all about?
I don't know.
How did you even have access? That was just from the library? You're like,
I just found it. I must have thought the title was funny. Nobody really, like, there were no restrictions on really what I read. So I just pick up whatever and read it. And they're like, kid's a reader, you know, that was the thing, that there was no kind of, I think they were like, she seems to know what she wants to do. So let her do it.
Yeah. And what's interesting is, as an only child, like, it's usually you see like, oh, you know, my day was controlled, you know, because I was the only child. So
yeah,
it doesn't sound like that was necessarily the case with you, or.
I wasn't allowed to do anything, but I was allowed to read. Like, I always had the kind of, my mom is super overprotective. So, I was just never really allowed to do anything. Having said that, we were at the, like, growing up anytime, but now that meant you were allowed to do everything, like get on your bike and ride around for 3 hours unsupervised. Right. That was always fine. I was on my bike a lot. I guess I did more. I liked stuff that had wheels on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I rode my bike a lot and roller skated a lot, like hours and hours and hours of that. And then,
wow. I mean, do you think she was overprotective because she's a nurse and she just, I mean, that seems like a natural, like, I don't want you getting hurt.
Kind of. Certainly she had, I think it's just her personality.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have that in you? Do you feel like you kind of manifested some of that?
A little bit. I have some version of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But my mom was like, it was just one of those things where I was really not allowed to do very much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Intellectually I was allowed to, but sort of physically it was like, just sit over there and remain still or go on your bike. Like, the bike is fine, but
yeah. Yeah. All right. So you got some exercise, but as you started growing up and going into high school, were you starting to kind of come into yourself a little bit more in terms of, like, you know, oh, I like this more than just reading books. I want to do something with this, and it wasn't math. You were pretty like, this is what interests me.
Also, I was a non-Catholic girl who went to an all Catholic girls private high school.
Oh boy.
So inside of a convent. So,
wow.
I had 4 years with it that definitely felt like I was in the Truman Show. Like, it was 4 years of utter bafflement. Just like, what's happening? What's like, so I think those 4 years forged me more than anything else in my life, because it was so strange. It was such a strange experience that it's colored everything I've done since then.
So I was that decision because, hey, this is a good school. We want you to have a good education. And the Catholicism had nothing to do with it.
The Catholicism, that never even occurred to any of us. I wanted to go there.
Oh,
my friends were going there. It was like the good school that was affordable.
Yeah.
You know, it was the one that, like, the price point was right, but it was also like a really good school, but it was like not the, you know, the super fancy, like not the super exclusive $1 billion a year school. It was like the affordable, really good school that you had to get into.
So, but you were, I mean, there were all the rituals attached to that, I assume, that were completely alien to you. And
no
all
idea.
The, oh, I all didn't the words know that. You had to memorize and sitting up and standing down. And
we just were very laissez-faire about that. We were just like, yeah, it's just a religion. It doesn't matter. We didn't realize how seriously other people took what specific religion they came from.
Right.
That it
especially
never,
if it's in a convent.
It never occurred to us that other people were a lot more particular. We just thought everybody was like, nah, it's all the same. Like, it's fine, whatever. Yeah. It was a real surprise. It was like day one, I was like,
I would assume you just don't know what's happening.
I'm in deep water.
Did it just make you uncomfortable because you didn't know what any of it kind of represented or meant? Or was it just like, all right, I've got to memorize these things and do these things and whatever, it's just part of my day?
It was a little both. I mean, the first year was a nonstop scramble. It was like those dreams where you're in a play and nobody's given you a script and then you're on stage. They knew all the words to everything. None of them were written down, but I had never heard any of these words before. They had mass memorized. I didn't know that was a thing.
Right. That's no joke. That's a big deal.
Yeah, it's an hour of words, and there's literally none of them are written down. Everybody just stands up and starts saying all this stuff, and you're like, so I turned to someone at my freshman year table the first year, my friend Laurie. I'd never met her before. I was like, I'm not Catholic. Please help me. And she was like, I got you. Just do what I do. And that is how I got through it. That was the first year. Also, I had religion 5 days a week. Ugh. So, and it was like really old school religion classes.
Yeah.
But after the first year, I kind of came back sassy. I was like, I'm out of fucks to give. Like, I'm just like, whatever. I'm not scared anymore.
Right.
And that is basically the course I maintained for the next 3 years.
So you said attending that school kind of colored everything else that followed. What are kind of those colors? Like what can you say? Like, oh, I'm this way. Mm. Well, I think like this because of those 4 years.
I had to kind of fake it till you make it a lot. Like, yeah. Learn not to freak out if you're in an uncomfortable situation that right. you really
don't know.
So
that's a very positive lesson.
Yeah. Like, it was a lot of like, I'll figure it out. I have to figure it out. I'm here for 4 years. What am I going to do? Also asking questions, because I felt like a lot of stuff went on at that school that people should have been asking questions about.
Huh.
Or just in general. And I was like, no one's going to ask about that. I feel like we should be asking about that. Like, I feel like that's a thing that we should all stop and ask about. Like, from the sublime to the extreme. Like, we had a very strange religion teacher in our sophomore year who disappeared 3 weeks before the end of the school year. That guy was shady. But shady. Mm. But one of the many strange things he did was one day he said, well, I learned when I was in seminary school for 6 months, that was a whole thing. We learned the mathematical formula that proves the existence of God. And I was like,
what is it?
I was like, can we see that? And he's like, you wouldn't understand it. I'm like, follow up. Like, shouldn't we spend all, like, first of all, I feel like more people would have known about that.
Secondly, right. Why isn't this in the news?
Like, why don't more people know about this? And if you had it, like, isn't that what we would spend literally all our time studying? Everybody, everywhere? Because I feel like people would look into that. I feel like that would be a thing, guy. So I don't know. I don't want to call bullshit on you, but I think we should. I think, and stuff like that would just happen and people would be like, sure.
Well, I think the telltale sign of bullshit on that is that having a formula to prove the existence of God negates the idea of belief, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The whole idea is that you just believe. And, and if you're in a seminary school studying formulaically God's existence, then that's something that's wrong right there.
There was a lot wrong with that particular guy.
So when you say ask questions, you're talking about maybe like not just being curious, but also like not sticking your head in the sand.
Right.
And ignoring things that, are clearly wrong, but everybody else is just kind of wanting to avoid the situation.
Or that you don't grow up in the system. So I didn't come from a system where like people had been exposed to hearing that those kind of things, since they were in kindergarten. I came in at 13 and I'm like, what do you, it was so foreign to me that I was like, this is just how this is. Like, I don't know. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me, but I don't want to offend you. I just don't know what's going on. And I feel like there should be some more questions asked. It was also very, very clear that we had an all-girls school, and this was kind of universally known and acknowledged within our school that all the guy schools just got a ton more stuff, truly more offerings, better class, just like they looked like totally different establishments. And the stuff that we were taught was weird. Like, senior year, I had a full 5 days, it was 4 days a week at that point, one full semester, 4 days a week of marriage class taught by a nun. Womp womp. Like,
oh my God.
Womp womp. What?
That, I mean, that does sound like a sitcom.
I could be taking a real subject, but instead, like, wow, something that I could use in college instead.
Marriage class.
I sit here and I study marriage taught by a nun for 4 full fucking days a week.
Oh my God. And like, and when you looked around at your peers, was everyone else like, what is this? Or a lot of them were just like, yep, this is what we do now.
I think that, I just think they thought like, this is just how school is, because they'd always had these kind of classes. And they're like,
yeah, yeah, what else would you have to compare it to? Yeah.
Like, it's just something we have to go through. Like, you go to Catholic school, it's like play stupid games, win stupid prizes. Like, you go to Catholic school and you're going to get a full, like, we've always had a full period of religion forever.
Yeah.
So this is just this variety. By that point, I was also a little used to it, but by that point I was so mad all the time.
Yeah.
Just defacing my book.
It sounds like you came out of that experience instead of what you could have been, which could have been kind of institutionalized, you came out with a greater sense of individualism, perhaps.
I think I decided somewhere along the line that either I was going to completely go along with this. Like, I think I remember, because I was 13 and I was like, what do? I convert? Like, do I just try to go along and fully embrace it, or do I actually put up my hand?
Yeah.
And it took a lot. Like, it took months and months of psyching myself to get to the point where I was like, nope, you can put up your hand.
Hmm. And then after that experience, you went to college, and I know you got your MFA from Columbia. So that was an entirely different experience. You know, now you're in the city. And you're not in a convent, and you just knew it, by the time you graduated high school, you're like, I'm going to be, you know, I'm going for my MFA, or I'm going to be an English major.
Oh, I knew I was going to be an English major. I didn't know about the MFA yet, because I don't think I knew what those were. We didn't really have a guidance department. We didn't have a guidance department. We had a room with some brochures in it, but we didn't have an actual guidance department. So
in high school or in college?
In high school.
Yeah. Well, no, your guidance was you're going to get married. And
yeah, the guidance was like, we did have a room with brochures in it. And there was this guidance department that you took your envelopes up there and they helped you get your recommendation letters together and certified with a school stamp. But some schools actually seem to have guidance that helped you pick a college, and we didn't have that.
Yeah.
So I was like, I don't know. I don't know how to get financial. Like, you just had to figure it out with your family.
Right. Right. So where was your undergraduate?
University of Delaware.
Okay. And then somewhere along the way, like, I'm going to go for the MFA because I want it. I mean, did you, so people who write, you know, so I didn't come into it until my 30s and I didn't have any background in writing, and other people like yourself, you know, kind of from day one, they're like, this is what I want to do. You know, when you're deciding to get your MFA, or as you're getting your MFA, were you thinking about the business side of things, of like, what are the realities of being a writer? What's a life of a writer look like, as opposed to, you know, I just want to learn to write well?
Well, I applied to, and I started 2 MFAs at the same time at Columbia. So in one in theater and one in writing.
Oh, wow.
Because I was I worked in theater I kind of did them both at the same time, and I was a dramaturg, and I got a job as literary manager when I graduated college. So I had a day job in an office and a night job helping run a theater company.
Hmm.
And I never slept. And I was like, well, if I want to work in theater, I have to get this background, 'cause there's a lot of like technical stuff you have to know.
Yeah.
But I also really am a writer. So I feel like I'm going to apply to both. And I got into both, and I started in the theater division thinking like, I know how to write, but I need this technical info. And then I decided halfway through, I was like, this particular dramaturgy degree is not really what I should have just gone right into the writing division.
Yeah.
So but I essentially completed them both.
Wow. But there was after that, as you're leaving, you know, your studies, there was no gravitation towards the theater at that point, or that was still kind of in your blood?
I was a little burned out on it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'd had enough experiences in small theaters, like putting out fires and people fighting over stupid stuff. And I was like, I just want to be writing. I cannot deal with these people. I can't do it. Right. The other thing about the writing MFA is they didn't teach us anything about the business. Not once, nothing.
That's super interesting because that's like, I mean, yeah. So I come from a business background. So when I got into writing, I'm like, okay, now I need to learn about the business side of it. And I had that acumen to at least know how to research and ask questions and stuff like that. But if you don't have that, you know, it's a fairly opaque industry.
Yeah. And especially then.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine. So yeah. And you don't have an idea, but will I be able to, you know, pay rent based on, you know, how long it's going to take 3 years for my book to actually come out, but I need to make money now.
They seemed very offended by the thought that people would ever want to know the business side of things.
Yeah.
There were never any, I remember one time they brought in three agents for a panel. Like you could go to in the evening one day for an hour or something, but you never learned about what agents did. You never learned about what book contracts were like. You never learned about any of it. That was something you were going to do on your own.
But I think the business side of it is some of the most fascinating stuff because like you realize like so many people don't really know what they're doing, like in the industry, and they're all trying, but there's like, you know, a lot of people are just guessing all the time and they, you know, they're not very divulging of information and it's up to you to kind of sleuth around and try to figure out kind of how the sausage is made.
Yeah.
And it's still difficult to do. So you got out of school and you have your MFA and you want to just go sit in freshly cut lawns and start writing your books?
The thing is, I like a lot of people that moved to New York who are in the arts, I always had about 20 jobs.
Yeah.
So I'm always writing, but also working. Like I'm writing, I'm working. I'm still kind of doing stuff with theater sometimes. Like your day is full of like temping and writing and like you're just hustling all the time. So my roommate, a friend of mine from undergrad that I moved to New York with, we moved together. And she went into publishing. Mm-hmm. So she was in publishing and she was basically my entrance into the business world. I was learning through her as I was writing. So she was the one that suggested that I try writing for YA because I was writing, mostly I was writing nonfiction.
Yeah. Oh.
And she said, why don't you try writing for YA? And I said, that's ridiculous because I was never allowed to go out as a teenager. So what am I going to write about? Like, turns out that's great. Like, turns out that's a really good prep for that.
Huh. But you thought you didn't have the perspective or the empathy to write YA because of your specific upbringing.
Yeah, I thought I just didn't have any good, like, I didn't know what that was. This was in 2002, 2003.
Yeah.
So I'm also like, what is that? But then, like, it sounds a little weird, but like, I was like, I'll show you. And I wrote some stuff. And basically, I got my first book deal before I knew even what, like, suddenly I had a deal for three books, then I had a deal for two more books. So I had five books under contract. And I was like, okay, I guess, like, let's go. Let's dance.
So it just clicked with you writing why. And it was just kind of this suggestion from a friend. Right? Like it could have been, why don't you write romance? Why don't you write thrillers?
I was never not writing. I was writing everything all the time, constantly. I tried all different forms. I went to school for it. You know, yeah. I was never not writing. So I would always, I gave this sample a go. Wow. Because I wanted to kind of, any job that I could get in writing, like to get a foothold in while I did more writing, like you're just, it's constantly kind of grappling hand over hand, like grab a hold of one thing so you can reach for the next thing. So
like, what kind of nonfiction were you writing?
Essays, like, my favorite was like the Santaland Diaries by David Sedaris. It was that kind of thing. And I was working on a book project for my thesis that was about people that lived in alternative timelines, like people that spend their lives living in a Renaissance identity or, you know, things like that. Like I found the woman that created the Renaissance Fair and I managed to track her down. I hopped on a plane and stayed in her house for a week. Like, I
Wow.
I'm always ready to, you just got to be ready to dance, you know?
Totally. And you stayed in New York after Columbia. That was the beginning of your, and so after growing up in this fairly sheltered, you know, Philly suburb and then going to a convent for 4 years, you're in Manhattan, you know?
Well, I went to college. I lived in, you know, I moved to London for a couple of months to do a, you know, you work abroad, you work in a bar and you.
Yeah.
So I was just kind of willing to give anything. I knew what I wanted. I knew I wanted to go to London for a little while. Then I knew I wanted to live in New York and I just did those things. I just kind of always jumped in with both feet.
Yeah. Well, that's usually a good way to do it. I mean, it's that there's a lot of, for a lot of people, there's a lot of failure in publishing and, you know, it doesn't sound like you've experienced a lot of that, but still like just going through it all and jumping in and just, you know.
Writing is mostly failure.
Yeah.
It's part of the process. So be very comfortable with it. Like, don't worry about that. If something doesn't go well, that's fine. That's exactly what should be happening. So don't worry about it.
And learn from it. Like, that's what I like. It's amazing the things you can learn from rejection. And if you open your eyes and your heart to it, you're like, wow, okay, now I have all these letters about why these editors won't take my book. And they're all saying the same thing. That's a lesson for me. Let's figure that out.
Yeah. Don't think of it as it's not failure. It's literally part of the material. It's part of the process. It's not failure. It's just submitting. It's just drafting. It's all one thing.
Right. So you have these book deals all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like maybe that was like, oh, whatever schedule I put out for my life, I feel like now all of a sudden I'm ahead of it. Maybe that you had expected to, you know, get more footholds and different jobs. But once you got these initial book deals, was that kind of, okay, here's the path now. It's I'm writing this and you know, this is going to take several years and this is, you know, the way I'm going now.
Yes and no. I mean, I feel like every book and every deal and every project is just, it's a new thing. You learn to write each book by writing that book. I think I tend to think of things in a very fluid manner. So
what does that mean?
That they aren't fixed points. Like the book's never really done. It just gets turned in. Like the book is, you know,
right.
You're working, you're just always in the flow of the thing. Like now I'm working on this project. I might be drifting this way or this way, but it's just all kind of one movement as opposed to like an achievement. Let's stop here and build a monument.
Right. Right. And everything's like that book that I wrote 10 years ago was a representation of who I was at that time. And for better or for worse, it reflects kind of my thoughts and feelings and passion and ability back then. And so I don't tend to go back and think about old things because I forget about them. And, you know, and it's always weird to have readers talk about older books. You're like, oh yeah, I don't even remember those characters' names. Cause that was just, it's just not something I think about very often. Do you start each book like with a fresh passion and a fresh challenge? And I'm so excited for this story, or is it sometimes like I've got to knock this out?
No, it's always fresh. It's just that, it's exciting to have a new blank. I like a clean desk, mm-hmm. despite what you see in the background here. I'm doing paperwork today, but I like a nice clean page in the notebook.
Yeah,
I like that.
Do you? Are you an outliner?
With mysteries, absolutely.
Yeah,
the mysteries are outlined to death.
Huh?
Literally, because they're murder mysteries.
How long does that take you? because I'm a pantser. So, and even if it's a mystery, like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I figure it out as I go along, because that's what's enjoyable to me. But so how long does it take you to sit before you actually start writing to actually kind of plot out an entire story?
The development of the mystery plots takes a couple months.
Yeah.
Okay. And I have every aspect of those crimes and all the reasons and all the details are completely hammered out before I actually start the book. Because for me, a murder mystery, these classic puzzle mystery, it has to be very, very clear. The exact mechanism of what happened and the why and the how and the who has to be very, very clear. And I have to have examined it from all the angles to make sure I've sealed it up. Like, this crime is set. Like, it makes sense. Everything is in place. I haven't forgotten about something. Now I'm going to wind up this mechanism and set it going.
And do you, as you're going through it, after you've done all of that, do you find cracks in it, or do you turn it into an editor and then they might say something like, well, I saw this coming on page 58, or are there changes you have to make to that perfectly kind of contained crime scene that you've created?
I look at it a long time. Like, I really test it structurally to make sure that I give it a lot of stress tests.
Yeah.
Tests.
I know what you're saying. Stress tests. What do you enjoy writing the most? Do you have something that, I'm most passionate about? X.
Mysteries.
Yeah.
Well, mysteries and nonfiction essays, both. Mysteries, I always wanted to write them because I read them so obsessively as a kid. And I always avoided doing it because somehow I think I thought it was too good for me or something, or like, you don't do the thing you're super passionate about.
Yeah, I get that. Or
also, I went to art school where you were certainly taught to look down on things like that. They teach a lot of snobbery in an MFA program.
Mysteries are compelling, and they're also very challenging, because it's like, well, how do I do something different? How do I do something unpredictable? And how do I do something that's like, I haven't seen a million times? Is that a consistent challenge for you, or you feel like everything you do is, has a different flavor to it, where it doesn't feel like it's of the typical genre?
Well, I definitely write along the classic genre, the classic mystery genre lines.
Right.
But the way you make a good one is, I think you really work at it. Like, yeah. I really think about, because I love it so much. I have this picture of the place and the people very deep in my head, because it's the Box in the Woods and the Stevie Bell mysteries are about a girl who solves historical cold cases that have complications in the present day. So that's something that those kind of cases live very vividly in my imagination. They're very, those trees bear a lot of fruit in my mind. So I kind of go around and pick a lot of fruit and go, what are the things that are the juiciest to me? Like, what do I really enjoy? And then I sit and I start to build my device. And then it's like an engineering project.
Wow. Yeah. That's really cool. It's totally an erector set. Yeah. Like you said, you're even using construction terms like stress testing, like you were making sure that, there's nothing that's going to make this collapse.
For the first one, the first Truly Devious book, there's a murder in it that happens in a sealed room. And I literally, because I married into a family of engineers, a bunch of English engineers, one of whom was a nuclear submarine commander, one stress tested ships, one's a materials engineer. Like, there was, there was a doctor in the room as well. And they were all gathered around lunch table. And I said, okay, everybody, I got the doctor, I got the submarine commander, I got the materials person, I got the ship person. Let me tell you what I'm going to do. And I had a room full of it, and we were passing around diagrams. I was like, all right, building the literally down to the dimensions of like what I needed to do. And
But you love that. I mean, it's clear you love that. I mean,
yeah, I really
and
do.
you have a background also that in research and, you know,
but not in science.
but you like researching it. You know, you like to learn, and that comes across very clearly. There's others who don't research as much. I'm not a big researcher because I just don't have a passion for it. So my books don't require, you know, that kind of level. But the people who do research, I think they do it because they're fascinated by everything that they're – whether or not they even use it in their books. There's probably a lot that you research that never even makes it in.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a kind of – one of the weird – like one of the – not weird, but one of the things I remember in a one of the MFA classes that really was super useful was one of our research classes. And they gave this weird rough estimate that, you know, mileage may vary, but they said, you know, maybe think about it this way. You're going to pull 4 times the amount of research that you'll ever use or more. Hmm. So you're going to research much, much more than you ever need to use.
Right. And a lot of that research lives in your brain somewhere that you might be accessing for other projects at any time that comes in handy. That's what I find fascinating about it. Well, congratulations on the Box in the Woods coming out. I know it's been a very busy week for you, but that's
great. It's been a very good week, aside from the minor explosions and things that have, you know,
right.
And those are just exciting.
Exactly. So we're going to do a very quick storytelling.
Okay.
And this is, I picked 3 books, and so I'm going to have you choose one, and then we're just going to pick a sentence from a random page, and we'll just kind of go back and forth just for a couple minutes, and I'll call an end to it. But we never know where it goes, and it's usually pretty fascinating. So you can choose from Hemingway's Farewell to Arms, actually Nightmares Unhinged, which is an anthology of horror stories.
Okay.
Or Ken Follett's Column of Fire.
Oh, let's do that.
Okay.
I don't know what that's about, so let's find out what's going on in there.
So pick a page between 1 and 900.
267.
Okay.
I bet it's going to be like, it's blank.
I wouldn't tell you if it was. And pick a sentence from like 1 through 5.
5.
Okay. So I'll read this and then give me a sentence or two, and I'll do a sentence or two, and we'll just see where it goes.
Okay.
Charles moved farther away from the crowd to make sure they could not be overheard, though no one was paying attention to anyone but the king now.
All right. So this is a court. So you just want a next sentence or?
Whatever, sentence or two, whatever pops into your head.
Sorry, I'm just thinking.
Oh, take your time. We can edit as much as we want out of this.
I don't write out with my voice. I don't know how to do it.
Okay. Well, we don't have to do it.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's like I was like, I don't know what to do because I think with my fingers. So but I could talk about it.
Okay.
I'm like, well.
So Charles
this is some shady court shit.
Yeah, shady court shit. Everyone's paying attention to the king. Mm-hmm. Charles is walking away with somebody to make sure they couldn't be overheard.
All right. So we've got court intrigue. I'm all right with that. I don't know what period this is, and I don't know what king, but I would like it to be Versailles because a million people lived in Versailles because you think, oh, what a beautiful, classy house. But no, it's like a weird apartment building and it's it stinks. It smells because everybody, like the dogs pee in the corners and the people pee in the corners. So it's like a big, crowded, stinky building with billions of angry people in it that all hate each other.
And it's hot.
And it's hot. It smells bad.
So then these guys are walking away and they're up to something and they're in the presence of the king, in the presence of a lot of people. And maybe they're talking about maybe an assassination attempt.
Well, yeah, it's got to be an assassination. Also, I think that you're never not in the presence of a lot of people when you're in these buildings. I don't think that there are many empty places. Only in like, you know, in historical dramas do you ever see, like, they're just very crowded.
So our takeaway from the story is Versailles is crowded and smells terrible, especially in the summer.
I think that the challenge is finding a spot where you can. I'm okay. In the background of your frame, you have a thing that says the crows have eyes 3.
Yes.
But I was just reading that as the crowds have eyes. Like, the whole point of places like courts in Versailles is that they are just miasma clouds of gossip art. So if gossip is the air everyone breathes, then the thing you need to manipulate is the gossip itself. Like, you don't ever really try to keep a secret. You just float a whole bunch of stuff.
Right. You start gaslighting.
Yeah. So it's all about manipulating because if you step off to the side with someone, everyone is going to turn and look at you and be like, what the fuck are those two up to?
Yeah.
So yeah. You just turn all of those opportunities to your own advantage. Like, because you don't ever go off to be not seen unless you do it to be seen, not being seen.
Right. Right. Purposefully.
Right. So that's what I'm thinking.
Okay. Okay. Well, we can just call it there. See, that wasn't so bad.
Oh, I didn't think it was bad. I just didn't know how to write anything with, like, my mouth.
Right. It's just not how you do it.
No, I think it's a hand thing. It's definitely like a typing or a pen thing, but it's not.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't really know how to do it.
That's quite all right. Well, listen, it was great talking to you, and congrats again on the book coming out, and of all your success. It's just I think you've demonstrated, like, you know, true commitment to the writing craft can bear, you know, crazy good fruit over the years. So congratulations.
Or, you know, just that there is no really one way that any of this gets done.
No.
So whenever people are like, this is how it's done and this is how writers do, no, like, it's how you do it. It's a large and flexible, it's a behavior, not a strict procedure. It's something that people do, as opposed to, you know, this is the formula, you know, this is the way it is done.
Right. And if you're following a formula or trying to, you're probably not enjoying it. And, you know, I find that writing only works if you're enjoying it. It doesn't work as, like, you know, a data entry job all the time that you hate, but you're thinking that you're going to be successful doing it.
Yeah. Writing is terrible. Don't do it unless you love it.
Right. Right.
Love this terrible thing.
Right. All right. That's a good takeaway to end on. All right. Thanks again. And enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you so much.
Take care, Maureen. Bye. So that was my conversation with Maureen Johnson, which was a hell of a good time. One of the most entertaining conversations I've had since I started recording this show. If you want to find out more about her, you can go to her hysterical website, which is MaureenJohnsonBooks.com. If you want to know more about me, please visit my website and subscribe to my newsletter at CarterWilson.com. Oh, we're hearing from Guff. This is the monster that screams every time I try to do anything productive in my house. That's it for now. Thanks for watching and listening. More episodes coming out soon. Until then, take care.